Make it more intimate? That would be great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Intimate?
Or don't. Don't be intimate.
You can't do it. Well, I hate when they make me move the furniture when I do
stuff.
Maybe
you should have figured
it out. Yeah, we should have figured it out.
Maybe we take everybody's stand and go a couple feet more.
Okay.
Is that what you want?
Yeah, we could. We couldn't that figure out how to really arrange it.
It does seem a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, come to us.
Oh, yeah,
Oh,
yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
We're
doing this.
Good. Well, no, just to remind me of titles are good because you titled them. Some of them, but some of them. Yeah, it'll just help me keep it. I don't know.
Yes.
I felt like I needed some information.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. This feels nicer. Thanks, everybody. It feels more a little more fun. Yeah.
That was my fault.
Thanks,
it's okay.
For coming.
Yeah. Thank you for coming. Yeah. So this is the closing program for the show. The show ends today. Is that right? Thank you, Danny, so much for and Pigeon Palace. Yeah. It's great to see the. It's great to have someone showing the work. And we talked last time. When we met, what was that? Was that a month ago or two weeks ago?
We did that other talk about white work.
We did talk about the white work and we talked about burial. And so we thought we'd end it with this, which is the most recent work that Mark's done. And I guess before we start to talk, it'd be great just to get people's impressions of what they're looking at. And so if you could just look around at this work and just the first word that comes to mind and just say it out loud. Mark and I will do improv based on that.
Okay, fragile?
Ominously fragile.
Ominous and fragile, okay.
I was thinking delicate.
Delicate, okay.
I was thinking cascade.
Okay, there's definitely...
I was thinking luminous.
So luminous, cascade, delicate.
And celestial.
Ominous and celestial, okay.
Chimey.
What's that?
Chimey.
Chimey, uh-huh.
If you get it out of the wind, for sure.
And so what's interesting about this is we're looking at sculpture or sculptural objects that also have the potential to make sounds. So there's something going on there. We also have objects that that kind of light up. So we have this great transition from making sculpture now to making more domestic objects, which are sculptures, but they're in a whole new way of relating to them. We relate to works in a gallery one way, and we relate to objects in our home another way. And so that's fun. But I was really surprised that some of them, like awesome, what was that, awesome? Is that what he said? Did he say awesome or overwhelming? Anyway, they're very large scale though still. So there's something going on with the scale. In terms of the scale, kind of what does it make you think about the fact that they seem so big?
I love how much is on them, but they seem so strong, especially the middle.
The middle one?
I love that one.
Uh-huh.
It's got a lot going on.
Yeah.
But it's like not going to collapse and not going to fall.
No.
I think they're pretty solid, and we had to, like, just help me build all this, so.
Yes, so look at
could not have done it. I mean, much of this work is four-handed, so it's not like I was sitting there doing something and he was sweeping up or something. We were like four-handed in the work, so you deserve
And I think he allowed you to work more on a larger scale because you were
exactly,
working on a smaller scale before.
Like that the center one, the two planky ones, these really elaborate ones here, I just could not have made those by myself. It literally took two of us like octopuses for 10 hours straight to make those. I mean, it was hard work for two people. So that's exciting. It's so fun when you get to do that, when you have those extra hands you could trust, because that's the other thing, you know what I mean? You have to be sure that person can work with you and make that happen. So we were really blessed to make that happen. I've been really lucky. This work over here, the white work, is pretty much just me. I did have an assistant who helped me with some cutting and helped me hanging out, but just one sort of assistant with that. Burial, I had a lot of help, a lot of people that I taught to sew, which was really exciting. Over the course of that work, I had people come to me who had like really rudimentary sewing skills. And I was like, I like you. I'm going to teach you how to work with silk chiffon. So you're welcome. And so they worked, some of those kids worked with me for a couple of years and really learned how to make clothes, like went on in life and were able to like do their thing, you know, because of their little apprenticeship with me. So that was really great. I love working with other people. It's so satisfying and it really just expands what you can do. It, and then someone can sit and listen to your stories all day. Let's be truthful.
and the delicacy that's in the work that's done with fabric and with cloth and with sewing, I did hear people talk about this as being fragile and delicate too. So you've maintained some of those qualities with this work.
It's such a different kind of fragility. I mean, yeah. I very purposely went from fabric to ceramic because I like the idea that I had something I could scrub in the sink with a scrubber, you know what I mean? Instead of these things that we have to store this stuff at our house, you know what I mean? And we have to store it in a certain way. We have to store it so it's temperature controlled. And it's not stuff that you display. I mean, we sometimes display the big floral one over there in our living room occasionally for a little while. But it's not good to have them out, you know? It's 100 million degrees here, and there's so much dust, and it's disgusting here. So those all have to be packed away. So I wanted to make stuff that I can have in the house, you know what I mean? And that you can clean, and that is useful. Of course, then it gets extravagant and stupid, of course, but yeah. That's my...
But it's it's gotten in some ways like where the burial work is very ephemeral. There's almost like a sheerness, a translucency.
Well, I mean, it's all built to disintegrate. Too.
Right.
I mean, it's all
it's very much
stuff. So
yeah.
Eventually, it'll be dust. You know, the whole concept of that was that it would.
Yeah.
Like if you cremated a person in one of those,
it would
all be gone.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Where this is has a this, more of a lasting.
This could last. If you
this
don't
could
drop.
It could last, but it lasts in a way that you need to have at your home, right? That you're using it, that it's part of your life, where this is something where we associate museums and things like that because they need to be displayed very carefully and conserved in a way that's more institutional. These are definitely just about the home. And so...
which brings us to domestic mysticism.
Domestic, yes.
Which is our official theme of our talk.
Yes. We have to figure out what it is.
I made that phrase up because we needed something to describe what I was doing.
But it's an interesting thing to think about because
it is, yeah.
Because when we talk about things like witchcraft, we're talking about things that are based on the earth elements, right?
And for me, well, like this work is obviously is about my relationship with my husband and our 23-year relationship together. And it's about sort of what you're able to accomplish in a long-term relationship. And a lot of that is to do with housekeeping and witchcraft. All those things are tied in, you know.
Right.
I mean, those things are really the same thing. You're cooking and you're candle making and you're garment making. And all of those things are really what witchcraft is about. You know, those are the things that, those are the way we weave spells. Those are the way we make our little spells. If you want to use that language. And I'm kind of like... a little ambivalent about using that language. I don't define myself as a witch, you know. I always say I'm witch adjacent. I know a lot of witches, and I know I do a lot of witchy things and all of that, but I don't define myself as a witch because I don't have a dogma around that. I don't have a practice around that. So I don't claim that, you know what I mean? But at the same time, just being a housewife is a bit of being a witch, you know what I mean?
Right.
But getting your meals together and getting all that together. And I'm super lucky I get to... basically be a housewife slash artist or artist slash housewife, whichever way you want to flip it. I don't care because
right.
I love both.
Right.
I'm super lucky to be able to do both, you know what I mean? But that mysticism does come into it. I mean, Kurt will tell you, I'm always cooking things up in a very particular way.
Right.
It becomes a very particular... Again, a practice. It's like an art practice, you know.
And as a couple, I think what happens is you start to build rituals into your day. You just
absolutely.
Do things in a regular way, and you fall into those kinds of patterns, and that structure is partly how you build a structure together that you're part of. And though I think when I think about witchcraft and domesticity, I think about women, of course, and that the artwork that women have made and the things that women have made have been often relegated away from the idea of a museum or the more male dominated art world until
and
recently.
Back into a more domestic.
Yeah, yeah. And and just even the using of fabric and thread, or the using of ceramics, maybe not as much. Well, there's so much to talk about with ceramics, but maybe not as much, but still, it's like it's something that women have been involved more in terms of the history. And so I think that's really interesting. And you're making it with your body. It's very body-oriented, and it's very...
Oh, yeah. Very about that.
Yeah. How was that to start working that way, where before you were working like this?
It was kind of... In some ways, it was really an easy transition because I immediately picked up... I signed up for, like, a series of clay lessons, and so over that series of, like, 8 lessons or whatever, they taught slab building, which is all what you see right here. That was the first lesson. I didn't get to the second lesson. I took that lesson, and I was like, oh, this makes sense to me. I made clothes always my whole life. I made garments. And so cutting things out of a flat piece of something just made sense to me immediately. It was like, oh, okay, slab building. I can do that. You roll out this piece of fabric or whatever, and then you cut it into pieces, and then you fit them together. And so I only needed that one lesson. I was like, okay, here I am. This is what I'm doing with clay.
Mm.
Every year I say I'm going to learn how to throw pots. And then I'm like, oh, I'm busy. I don't have time.
Mm.
Maybe this year I'll do it.
I also think it kind of, you found what worked for you and
yeah, exactly.
What was going to allow you to express yourself. Yeah.
I could like very quickly translate this new medium into what I already knew.
Yeah.
And put those together and then be able to, like, I've only really been doing clay for like 3 years. So this, I would say this is fairly sophisticated for 3 years in.
When you first started doing the big ones, from the look, I've seen some of your smaller work up.
Yeah, I was doing really small stuff until November.
That's my question. Did you just know, okay, now I'm going to do something big? And it was just like,
I had an opportunity to show my work in a gallery, and I was like, I need to step it up. And so I knew that. That's me, you know. I'm like, okay, here's an opportunity. I need to step my pussy up and get this and make it big and make it technically very strong so that it can hold up next to this thing.
Right.
Because that's like a lifetime of training and self-training and hours and hours and hours of practice. I mean, hours of practice to do all that. That to learn to knit to the point where I was able to knit that dress. I knitted that dress from the top down for a particular model, so it fits her. If you were able to see her, I mean, it's like couture. It's amazing. And it's knitted. It's not cut out of fabric and fitted. It is knitted. You know, to get to that point took hours and hours and hours of failure and just like going, okay, well, there's 3 or 4 days of work that I'm just going to toss to the side. You know what I mean? So all this stuff took all of that, took decades of that. This is 3 years of going, oh, I think I can do this.
But it also makes sense that you were having to figure out how to make it work with the ambition and the scale and the labor involved with the other work.
Yeah, I didn't want it to look shoddy next to this.
Yeah, I could see where like little tiny clay pot. This is what I'm making now.
A little sad plant pot.
And there's some, so let's look at some of the objects together because, this is why I have the list out. Now these are...
Ryan just followed me around all day and just like...
Well, you kind of sprung it on me, by the way.
Like which?
Well, in the beginning, when we first talked, it was like, we were going to show white work. And then about, like, the next time we talked, or the third time we talked...
Well, that was like 3 years in between.
No, I know. And it was like, oh, well, now I'm showing ceramics.
Well, I had to do it.
And we're going to do a retrospective. I was like, okay, sure.
I had time to learn how to do it in that between the time we talked about showing this.
Yeah.
But that's also a certain amount of trust that you could see the vision that's going through all the work. And then no matter what medium you're using, Mark, you're going to bring the same stuff.
Bring it every ball.
Yes, you bring it every ball, exactly. And I think, I've been really trying to think about magic and making objects because there's something there. And I don't know exactly what that is yet.
We all have it if we're creative people and you make things, you make drawings, so you know. It's a lot of it is your technique and all these things and your 1,000 hours of knitting to learn how to knit, but a lot of it is just like letting go and letting it flow. That's the main thing. That's where the magic is. That's where the that's where the magic happens.
I think because
you just kind of go, all right, it's out of my hands now. I'm just going to make this shit. And that's what happened here.
And there's a process. Like,
bang, 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 bang. Yeah. This is all new techniques for me. I'm not a sculptor. 2024, I was making more like the clock, these more like structured, very like Art Deco sort of structured pieces. So I had never done anything sculpture-like until I started making these log lamps. You know what I mean? And then I was like, all right, well, I designed it, I planned it, I have to do it, you know what I mean?
And
so the technique building happened as we went.
And it seems to me, and I don't know, but so part of it is, the magic part for me is the process. And when you're doing high craft, which this is high craft, or concept, you know, they're conceptual objects too. But when there's something's highly crafted, you go through this long process, and then things kind of come to your mind.
They
start
happening.
All the ideas and things start to connect together.
Well, and it happens,
they have their own logic.
In a progression too.
Right.
Like the log lamps, you know, sort of create this raw material that we grow here.
Right.
And the plank lamps, these two guys, this one and this one, is where we've shaved down those logs, right, and made them into planks, like you make lumber, right? So it's sort of a progression.
Is that why there's this design?
Yeah, there's wood grain on the back.
Oh, so there's wood grain on the back. I was like, okay, that's so interesting.
So it's like they were sliced, you know what I mean? I mean, that's our little...
I know, I love that too. It also kind of brings the stars... It kind of brings the stars back to Earth too. It kind of, because there's a connection between what's in the sky and what's on the ground.
Well, for me, it's always I survived Seattle for 35 years by looking at the plants, because the plants, I lived on Capitol Hill, and there were these beautiful homes with beautiful gardens and beautiful plantings. So I could watch them. I couldn't afford to travel. I never could afford to go anywhere.
Mm.
So it was the plants, watching the plants, that kept my eye fresh and kept me creative and excited and engaged. And when I came here, it was the sky.
Mm.
And so everything I've done since I've been here has been about the moon and the stars and the sun, because that's what I watch every morning. I get up super early. I watch the sunrise. I watch the craziness of the moon and stars that happens above us here, which is just magical. You don't get that in Seattle. You don't see that because it's the light pollution and the clouds. You know, here it's so clear. There's no light pollution. You see, I would see these. If you see my paintings, I have got paintings at home. If you see my paintings, they often go from dark to light, you know, because in my backyard, when I get up at 4 a.m. or whatever, and I sit in the backyard drinking coffee in the morning, and the sun starts to come up, it goes from that beautiful orange stripe that we live for at dawn and dusk into the blackness on the other side, and you can see all of it at once. It's this expanse that you can see all at once, and that to me has been my big like, that's the thing here in Tucson, like like the plants, like the Japanese maples and the freaking witch hazels in Seattle, you know, that would just boggle my mind all year round. Here is the sky, and it's that. So that's what
the background of the photo has it.
Yeah, the background, that's from one of my paintings. Yeah.
So wait, what part is the painting? Is
the
background?
Of the photo, I had a painting blown up into a big backdrop. We went through craziness to make that picture for you people. It's called The Family Business. It's Kurt and I and Ghosty. And Jess helped us with that. We were just about to share the credit on that picture because we made that picture happen. It's my cactuses in the backyard. We're shooting through the robe that I'm wearing is, you can't really see the print, but that's the Annie print. That's the Annie Vandez print that I made it was a wallpaper we had in our house in Seattle. And then I made it into fabric here and made it into the robe so that she's part of she's the patron saint of our house. And so she's part of that too.
And
I love that photograph so much.
And it kind of it makes me think a lot about when I was a kid, and I was meeting queer people for the first time.
Meeting queer
people for the first time, and didn't even know what it was, and didn't think anything about myself. That there was this kind of world making queer.
Our elders did it.
Our elders did it. Yeah.
I mean, are you familiar with the work of Stephen Arnold?
Stephen Arnold.
I mean, when I was a coming of age, I also had an older brother who I've talked about a lot as an artist. Who's similar to Stephen Arnold in some ways, you know, his aesthetic was similar. And so to grow up and see those, you know, for me, that was my aspiration.
Yeah.
Those were my aspirational artists. And Stephen Arnold, still very much, I think you can relate my work to him.
Very ornate, very, you know.
But very made yourself. Made yourself.
Made yourself.
Creating your own world.
Right.
In your studio.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just kind of like your whole home is basically a set.
Well, and that's what's happening at our house.
It's a staging area.
It really is. It's like, I said to Kurt a couple of years ago, I sort of gave up when I stopped doing this work, the white work stuff, and sort of stopped pursuing that track.
Right.
We'll call it.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? I'm going to work on the house.
Yeah.
I'm going to make stuff for the house. I'm going to make stuff for us. I'm going to fix up the backyard.
Yeah.
And then when we die, they will have the gayest garage sale ever. And then they'll have to burn it to the ground because it'll be so gay that nothing else can ever happen.
Right.
But and working in our home has always been like one of the core things that's really
beneficial. Oh, totally. Working at home has been amazing. There were times in Seattle when I had a studio outside the house.
Mm.
But it's when it's working at home and working for home. Again, working for, rather than focusing on, you know, contemporary art, which I was doing over here, which is more like a museum sort of fancy gallery track. It's more like I'm making shit for the house.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, this stuff, not all of it. I don't want to take all of it home. If you know what I'm saying? But a lot of it is going to fit right in the house. You know,
right.
I'm going to take it home. Like these, the planters with the lights, those are mine. You know what I mean? Those are not for sale. Those are
but don't you wouldn't want, don't say it. You know, you maybe someone will want to buy it.
Well, I would sell
it
for an extraordinary amount of money. Yes.
But one of the things I think that we can say is that, and this happens a lot with artists, is that especially career artists, they have to think over and over about this white cube that feels that isn't the same place as one's home, and doesn't have the same like emotional resonances. It's more like you're writing literature. It's like a white page that you're writing on. And that's kind of often how I think artists are having to think about galleries, because they're these spaces that are separate. There's artists who've been trying to take their studios and try to make the gallery like their studio, or artists who turn them into living rooms and things like that. So this is a very similar situation where you're like, the meaningfulness is at home, and you want to make sure your art is meaningful, right? And so you had to get away from thinking about the gallery space. Doesn't mean that the work isn't still art. It just means that it's not talking to all the things that artists who've always worked in these gallery spaces think about. The white wall, where it's placed on it, how it looks on a podium. All of that, right? Those are things that artists have to think about. Maybe not the first thing they think about, but certainly it's part of the process of showing the work. So what's cool about this is that you've even put it together almost like a home altar, you know?
Most of it was in our living room for a while, for a few weeks before we moved it over here, and it was really pretty cool. It was a lot.
It was a goddamn enchanted forest.
Yeah.
We want to take it down a little bit, but I am taking some of them.
But I also, there's so much I do want, now that we're talking, there's so much I want to talk about, because that too muchness, I think, is a very gay thing. If you're a gay male, or even, you know, just if you're queer, you're often told you're too much.
Always.
Too much emotion, too much aesthetic,
well,
too much preciseness.
About being married for 23 years, you have someone who tells you it's all right. You don't have the people that shamed you all your early life for being too much. You have somebody who says, yes, you are exactly too much. It's wonderful. Keep
yeah.
going. You know, keep doing it.
And that's the, I think, also magic too, because
Absolutely.
It's allowing that unconscious and that whatever it is, the life, now I'm getting all, let's see if I can think of another word. It just allows your life force to be constantly expressing itself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that too muchness is about, for me, that life force, you know? So I think that really, I love the too muchness of it. And there is, of course, there's been trans and maximalism for a long time. And minimalism is often associated with the desert, and a lot of the artists who've escaped New York to go to the desert and make very minimalist works.
Your white stucco wall and your, you know,
yeah.
your lone cactus.
But I also think that this maximalism is also about kind of creating, being enchanted by
well,
the objects around you.
Like I'm redoing our dining room right now.
Right.
So I like painted the ceiling, like this huge, like crazy, like sun rays. Again, if you've seen my paintings, you would recognize it because I do the same thing again and again and again. So it's like radiating rays out from behind the chandelier, and now I'm making the hanging bits for the chandelier out of ceramics, and you know, doing some decorative painting on the walls.
Right.
It's just so much fun to focus it on that, you know. I worked when burial happened in Seattle, I worked with this very evil curator who will remain nameless, but she's just evil, horrible person. And but the one thing I did learn from her, she had been the curator at the Franz von Stuck house in Germany, wherever that is, wherever Franz von Stuck is from. The German Expressionist.
I'm just thinking painter. Sound of Music. I don't know why, but
German Expressionist.
Oh, the von Trapp family. Yes.
But his house was a Kunstwerk. It was.
Oh yeah.
Everything had he peed in every corner.
Right.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
And so she introduced that concept to me. So no matter how evil and rotten she was to the core, she gave me that. Like I had never really heard of that. I guess I knew of that, or I would have thought of that, but. You know, the idea of just like imprinting everything about the house and making that your museum, that your artwork.
Right.
And so that really inspired me. It was like, well, yeah. I mean, for the first time in our lives, we own a house rather than renting in Seattle, which we did for decades and decades and decades. And so any changes we make are ours, you know, and they're super valuable and we're not going to get screwed out of them. You know, like the gardens I've planted that suddenly you're like, well, you're out. Sorry. You know, sorry you spent all those years and all that money on your garden and you gotta go. You know, it's different now. So it's nice to be able to do that.
And so that kind of leads me, actually, we're looking at a piece right now, which is right here. It's almost like a little nest or a hollowed out thing. So it's like, this the one in the middle. It's almost like the idea of nest building, you know, that couples will build nest. Or not even couples.
Birds very much are, little birds are very much a symbol of domestic happiness.
Yeah.
Know? And our house actually is infested with sparrows. There are all these goddamn sparrows that live in the oleander. So many of them, and they're just a nightmare. They eat all my seedlings, and they're terrible. So that's why they're all there.
But also, it is very much, all of this has that flavor of domesticity. There's also, I guess for me, I think about stars as a lot of different ways. Now I'm thinking about the iconography. Like, we have this iconography that's repeating over and over. And I grew up with Peter Max, pillowcases, sheets, and,
absolutely.
You know, they were everywhere.
Yeah. Also domestic objects. I had Peter Max blow up pillows.
Right.
Know, everything with a cloud and a sun ray and a star, you know what I mean? I mean, obviously, I'm still poisoned by it.
And the 70s, you know, the 70s, there was a lot of, and even glam rock 70s has a lot of stars in it and a lot of rays of light shooting out. It's very much
about that joyousness and that energy and just that.
And do you think about, so when you're thinking about these stars, does that kind of make sense to you in terms of, are we thinking about pop, or are these more symbols for things in the universe?
A pop sort of vibe.
You know,
I come from that. Peter Max was enormously influential to me when I was like in the third and fourth grade.
Right.
Super important as an artist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so those things still crop up. And again, I've talked about my brother so many times, and his aesthetic was very much rooted in an early 70s, late 60s Tucson.
Okay.
Desert kind of pop thing. And then my thing, I came a bit later, 14 years later, my thing was disco. And so then there's that too, like we see in the lounge in there.
Right.
I would say to Cliff, you know, that's the nighttime version of our house. Our house is the daytime version of that room, you know, basically it's a very similar aesthetic.
And again, but I think this also, the disco, the way I've understood it, from my own experience and just a little bit of the history, is that it's a multicultural movement.
Absolutely.
I mean, disco went across rich and poor. It went across all race and it went across all sexualities. So it's very much about celebrating and being joyous and being in the moment, moving your body and all of that. And so I feel like that disco has got kind of countrified a little bit here, you know, which is fun to see. So I have that relationship to the stars. Well, now these lamps you call faggots.
Yeah.
You know, because of course faggots are also sticks. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's fine.
Do Do you want to talk a little bit about the lamps and kind of what you were thinking?
Well, they're just sort of like, you know, I don't know. It's, well, back when I used to... Oh, shit. All right, I'll edit that a little bit. All right.
You can do it. Yeah.
Martha Stewart did a piece in the 90s, and I happened to be lounging around my apartment during that time, watching a lot of television, drinking a lot of orange soda, and she did a segment on faux pas, on fake wood, faux pas.
Oh, so, cool.
Like Victorian garden furniture that is often like really rough concrete, these like really rough concrete sort of benches and logs and stuff. But then there are also more delicate sort of ceramic pieces, you know, that are little hollowed out logs. You've seen them from the 40s and 50s, little, you know, little fake log pieces. And for some reason, I just thought that was the gayest and craziest and just most ultra thing. And it always sort of stuck with me. And so when I started doing clay, that it just really leads to that. It's just really easy.
Yeah.
And so then I just dove into it. I mean, for whatever reason, this period of work, because I just started this work in December. So it's only really been 7 months that I even started any of this. This is all very different, except for the clock. Is all very different than anything I was doing even last year. It was a big change. And it was that football moment. And that was me just making a choice and just going, okay, well, this is super fun. And I like how decorative it is. I like the idea of these log lamps with the, I saw that those cast glass globes were available. And I was like, well, it's easy to design around those, you know, and suddenly you make these things. Although I have to say, when I did a Google image search on my lamps, there's nothing like them. So, yay for me. Just to be a little snotty, I mean, I thought that was pretty cool. I was like, oh, yeah, there's nothing. Nothing comes up. Like, really confused things come up. There's some like, 1950s Halloween plastic blow, you know, those blown plastic decorative things? There are a few of those things. And I was like, oh, well, that's a good... You know, that's a good correlation, but that was really it. So I was really proud of that. I just felt like, oh, I kind of put something new together there.
I did think a little bit about Christmas candles. Do you remember those red Christmas candles? Just because the light bulbs are similar, but...
The light bulbs, I mean, those globes are so amazing. Yeah, they were pretty. I love them so much. I had so much fun with those.
And what I've noticed too is that this thing with the small, and as they get bigger, it looks like you've started to work in pieces. Was that, because it's just, you can't make them so big.
I think our deepest kiln at the co-op is maybe 22 inches.
Yeah, so that allowed you to
do
that.
And so the plank lamps, those tallest lamps, the one in the middle and then the other two tall ones, before they shrink when you fire them. Because the liquid comes out of them, so they shrink quite a bit. So those were about 22, 24 inches when they went in. So those were about the max height you could get. So we could have gone taller on the stacked ones, but it was just like trying to be manageable, you know what I mean?
How many inches do they lose?
They lose 12% about. So if they were 22, then they're probably about... What, 20? I don't know. I can't do math. It's not a problem.
And there's some lovely details, like even the top of the logs. Are they separate? Are they loose? Yeah. And so they're just stuck.
Yeah.
But they have a core.
Watching them build this in the living room was incredibly stressful. It's like, because this is the art and it's happening.
Yeah, there's a post. There's a post up the center.
So it's been stabilized at the center. But what's nice about it is the top of the logs.
They're off.
Well,
and
that's,
they're glazed on the top.
And they're glazed on top. Which
really, we were super careful about the glazing, and we were very like specific. We glazed the blue stars on the outside. But we mostly really wanted to go with this iron oxide, with this red. And if you've been to our house, which many of you have, is also, it's a white stucco over brick, 1927, very Tucson house, but it's got the red oxide trim, and I painted the fence in the backyard, the red oxide, it's a very common paint color. I love red oxide because it's rust, it's just rust in a paint bucket, you know what I mean, and this is the same thing in a different formulation you wrote on, so I just love that red, it carries through the house, it's more about the domestic part of it, you know what I mean.
The fact that you...
The glazing adds this wonderful glass. You know, it's basically a sheet of glass over it that melts onto it. And it gives it a wonderful sound.
It also bounces the light around. I mean, one of the interesting things about like why they used to do the gold altarpieces is because you think about it this way, the only lighting you have in a church is the candle. So it bounces the light around and it makes everything everything much more light. And so I think that bouncing the light around with the glaze is really important too, in that it's different than the surface of the clay. When you, the fact that you moved into a 20s house, do you think that influenced your work? Were you?
I've always been sort of.
You always were. You were already attracted to that. Yeah.
it's Art Deco, it's sort of what we do.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, that was part of it. But then when we moved in and I realized, I mean, it's a very humble Art Deco house. It's not fancy.
No, yeah, yeah.
But it's got some wonderful little details and little arches. And above the doors, there's a little bead of wood that goes across, you know, that's super simple, but it gives it that little bit of modernist care, you know, in a 1927 house in Tucson, Arizona. I mean, imagine, it's fabulous. So you look out the front window and you see the mountains, and then you look out the back kitchen window and you see the other mountains. So you have it on both ends. It's just a wonderful little place. And I always think about the people that built it and what it must have been like in 1927 when you're doing the dishes, I do the dishes, and I look out the window and the sun's setting and the mountains, and it's amazing. And you just think about how magical it must have been at that time. You know, because it's magical now, it's still wonderful, you know what I mean? But at that time, just imagine 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking even at the cords are those twined cords that you would get from the time. Like, you didn't go with a plastic cord.
Oh, yeah.
So all these
I like nice materials, as you can tell.
Yeah.
I mean, this stuff is all silk and wool. There's nothing, you know, I like, other than these pants, which are cheap.
It's the same cord from the hanging lamps, so we braided them through the chain. It's the same cord.
Oh, nice,
cord.
Yeah.
It's all the same.
Really takes me to another, again.
And I've got to say, for the lamp making community or whatever that is, the people that make these pieces that we put together to make these lamps are all these disparate small companies, most of them in the United States.
Okay.
You know, they make these globes, make the little fittings that they sit in,
right,
make the cords, a lot of different companies, but they all have their shit together so everything fits. There's never a question like, is this little thing going to screw onto that properly?
Yeah, we only had like one piece that didn't work. It had
oddly flawed piece.
A tiny little
thing. But for the most part, you order all these disparate pieces and suddenly, boom, 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 boom.
Right.
They all just screw together. It's such a cool thing. And they were so nice. Like at one point, one of the big lamp bases, those are marble, black marble bases on those. And one of the big ones was warp that they sent us.
Mm.
And we sent it back and they shipped a new one and credited me before I even mailed the other one back. I mean, they were so on it. That little group of manufacturers, that little group of people was just so, it was just really impressive. You know what I mean?
What was I going to say? Is there any questions that people have in terms of things we haven't talked about?
We're going to have other people talking. You and I have talked a lot.
Yeah, we talk a lot. Is there things that come up when you look at the work or questions you might have? Or?
Well, I was just curious because so much of your art previously is really in the realm of decorative arts, right? Classic, you know, if you went to the Met, it would be the decorative art section. And everything that you're now doing is, although utilitarian is not a bad word, it has utility, right? Like, you can have a planter. It would shed light in a den. And I'm wondering, did you have any fears as you crossed that transom to utility? Like, oh my God, I'm going to make something that somebody's going to use.
No, I'm so excited about it. So excited about it. I've only been doing ceramics for 3 years, and I've made more money doing ceramics than I ever made doing any of this. Believe me. And I'm talking about decades of work, you know what I mean? You can't get your money back making this stuff. It takes so long. It's stupid. It's stupidly a long process. That piece of oleander that's on that, over there to the right by those gloves, there's a piece of white oleander, silk oleander. If you were to take a branch of oleander, the only difference that you would notice would be the color of the leaves. Because I have photographs of real oleander and my oleander next to each other, microscopic, and you can't really tell the difference, you know, with the naked eye. And I was driving myself crazy doing that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? Just like, what am I fucking doing? What is the point of this, you know? It just got to be insane. It just got to be so crazy, you know, that it was an easy transition to go, you know what, I want to make stuff that we need some new lamps. I hate our lamps, you know? And a lot of the reason I know how to do all of this stuff is that I could never afford anything. I could never afford the clothes I wanted, so I had to learn how to make clothes so I could have designer clothes without a designer budget, you know what I mean? And it's sort of the same thing. I can't afford the nice housewares I'd like to buy. I'd love to be buying, you know, gorgeous Italian things from the 70s, but that's not us, you know what I mean? I need to make it myself. Which is great, you know, I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining. I'd rather it was this, you know what I mean? I'd rather have my living room full of my work, you know, than something else.
Well, what I think is interesting is with Burial, I mean, Burial it is fundamentally work about utility. Burial was designed for a very specific purpose to be used by a very select audience. But it was for those very specific people. It was for those models who were not the audience that would actually perhaps purchase and display the art. These pieces are very much, yes, for display, and these are utility that sort of open up the possibilities. You didn't just create these for very specific people. You created them to be in our home and speak to a very wide audience.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Other things that people are thinking about?
Can you talk about where the globes, the glass part, how did you do that?
I found them online. You know, there's it's several different companies. Actually, if you look at them, they're all slightly different. But they're traditional Art Deco glass globes that have been being made in cast glass since the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
And they still make those.
So they look very vintage. And
they are. I mean, they're the same things they've been making since the 20s and 30s.
It's probably molded glass.
Yeah, it's molded glass.
And they probably just have the same mold.
Poured into a mold.
Yeah.
I love them so much. I mean, I couldn't have done it without them. When I discovered them and I realized they came in three sizes, I was just like, oh, this is my whole... You know, this is my whole thing. This is what we're going to do. You know what I mean? So I adore them. I think they're wonderful.
And they were cast away without the sandblasted additions, like part of how the glass is formed.
Yes, this, I forget what it's called.
I do too. It's like not smoked, but it looks frosted. Like it's frosted. Yes, it seems to be frosted. Yeah.
But it's not a finish on the outside. It's the glass itself is translucent.
And then it's in a, is it that sort of a brass?
Yeah, it's like a brass setting that it sits in. I think they're traditionally hung the other way. I think they're on like chandeliers, you know,
right. And
hung down.
And they're specifically bought and then manipulated them to make the patina more present.
Yeah, we put them in vinegar and urine and everything else.
That sounds magic.
I did pee on something. Maybe we should
let him have it.
And then one more question about, did you have to roll those out like dough before, and then form them?
You roll out a slab of clay. It's like a pastry roller, sort of. And you roll out a big slab. And in some of these cases, we had to piece slabs together. So we'd have to roll out, like, say, a 14 by 20 piece, which is about as big as we can roll in our studio. And then we'd have to seam them together to get a little bit bigger for some of the pieces. But yeah, it's a big flat piece, like pastry. And then you cut it out. You know what I mean? I make the pattern of the piece and then cut them out. And then
just while sort the clay is wet, you form it.
It's all about like some of them, like the round ones, the round cone ones, and the log lamps. You do it while it's pretty wet, and it's got some sag to it. Like you can see at the bottom, they kind of sag a little, makes it look a little more natural. But then there are other ones, like the more structured ones in the front. We have to cut those pieces out, and then let them dry to just the perfect spot where they're dry enough that they'll stay really flat like a board when you put it together, but you're still wet enough that you can seam them together. So super different, very different process between those two, which is why these are so hard to make. Like with the second one, if you get up under that second one, you can see that it blew up in the kiln. It looks like a big tornado came up under it and blew it apart. It's because those pieces were not quite right when we put them together. It was the end of a 10-hour day, and you finally do that last seaming together, and it just went, and it just made a, it just swerved off and didn't work. And all the repairs that we put into it, we spent hours trying to repair it and trying to make it work, and it just made it worse, so that when it went into the kiln, it just went, just like, just blew up, you know what I mean? You couldn't repeat it if you wanted to. It's actually kind of amazing.
Yeah,
it's my favorite one.
Yeah. But that, like, that's, yeah, that's the process part. I was curious, like, do you plan them and draw them out first, or is it just the process of building them by hand?
I do a little sketch.
Little sketches? Messy. Yeah. Yeah. But then sometimes things happen in the kiln, or things happen.
Things happen in the kiln for sure.
And then you have to kind of work with that.
Don't so much happen in the studio, though. If I know I'm going to make something in the studio, I pretty much know what it looks like before I make it.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I make it.
Interesting.
Yeah. But that'll change in the kiln.
So in the kiln, they're not resting on anything.
That was sort of standing on its bottom in the kiln.
Right. But the round ones and everything, you're just sticking, like, they're not. I don't know what I'm trying to say.
You can lay them inside ways like that one was, right?
It depends on which part of the process. First, you fire them twice. So you first fire them without blades. It's called a bisque firing. And that's a lower temperature. So that's the initial firing. And then you glaze them and fire them a second time. So the first time you fire them, you can stack them all together. They can be touching or whatever. But the second time, the glaze firing, they can't be touching because that glaze will stick to whatever is next to it. So that's where the crazier things happen. It's a higher temperature.
The other thing that's kind of interesting, because we've talked a lot about the crafting of it, but we haven't talked about, like, there's a jewelry-like aspect to a lot of this, too. Because I was noticing, like, the chains and how you kind of have to, they have, the pieces are made separately, and then you have to assemble them. And I was, because I was noticing that hand, and I was looking at, well, what are these symbols on the hand? Then I realized, well, just rings. They're your rings, right?
Mine, personally.
Yeah.
It's a Gemini symbol and a sun symbol and a moon symbol. So it's fancy. Yeah. My symbology is not difficult to figure out.
Yeah,
it's
but
super easy. It's like clouds and stars and moons. And not trying to be anything, you know, super deep.
No,
It's more just about, like, life in the desert and the beauty of what we live with here, and the all-seeing eye, honey.
Yeah, what's up with
the all-seeing eye? Well, think about it. It's there. I think it's there, the all-seeing eye. Maybe it's the sun. I'm not religious or anything.
Because a lot of times knots on trees look like eyes and stuff, too. Yeah, I was thinking they're almost like animated, especially with the birds. They can pop in and out. There's little holes.
I love the birds
so
much. And they're molded. We did not sculpt the birds. They're molded.
And there's some also in the bar, too.
Little single ones.
Yeah.
Still have some for sale.
Christmas ones. Yeah. Take them up in the gift shop on your way out.
Plus, if somebody wants to go home with a lamp, we'll make a deal today.
Okay.
Sometimes.
Yeah, because it kind of, I mean, this is my own stuff. It kind of reminds me of Laugh-In, which was an old TV show in the 60s, mm-hmm. where there are these little windows and people,
where they pop out.
You know, like a cuckoo clock or something, they pop out, they tell a little joke, and then they go back in, you know.
Well,
so there's
tall,
a lot of that. Yeah.
The tall lamps, the two on the ends, are really very much designed for our living room. And
yeah.
The one with the hand, in my mind, where it sits in our living room, is facing when you walk in the front door, that hand is going to say, watch yourself in my house.
Right.
Like,
no, yeah.
And then the other one sits on the other side of the room and watches the interior of the house, this one, and is like, you know, Kurt and I at the top and the eye watching, the protective
eye.
It's all about, and again, back to domestic mysticism, it's about sort of creating a little, I don't know what the right word is, but
well, people
creating that magic to protect your home, which at this time we very much need to do.
And especially if you feel like your home is being threatened or your lifestyle is being threatened, definitely. And I think a lot about feng shui. People use chimes to hire energy in homes, or they use light to bring energy into darker corners. It's all based on how people were trying to feel safe in caves when it goes back to its roots. So it's really, yeah, it's very interesting, like, to think about the feng shui parts of it too, yeah. Or the ways that it changes the environment in your home, yeah. Because really, whether you're buying work from a gallery or you're buying work that's crafted in more of a shop, you are buying it for your home, unless you live in a museum. And so it does change the energy. I mean, people who purchase art have to think about how you're going to live with it. With me, I've always wondered, like, I can't live with this work. That's why I can't live with my work. It's why I make it, to get it out of me. But some people want to live with it. You know, they're just like, thank God.
I don't anybody else's work in my house. People give me things and I feel so bad. I'm like, Kurt, will you take this to your office so I don't have to have it in the house?
Yeah. Yeah. Is there anything?
I want all my stuff.
Yeah, anything else? Yeah. Okay.
Like, you know, you think of witchcraft a lot and witchiness as an alchemy, you know, and that's very much what a relationship is too.
Absolutely.
You have to rely on this alchemy, and also to make these things, you have to rely on alchemy. Mm. And the energy that they give you is also an alchemy. So that's what I get.
Yeah.
That's how I'm summing it up.
Okay, so
no, but that's what I'm, this, when the more I'm sitting here looking at the pieces, that's what it's making me think about a lot.
Yeah.
It is that alchemy. I mean, it could, I'm going to get sentimental and cry again. I cried the last time we talked about
it. We're counting on it.
But I'm going to try not to cry this time. The fact that I get to do this.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? And I get to do it because of our relationship. I couldn't do it on my own. You know what I mean? I can't fucking support myself. Kurt pays the mortgage, you know what I mean? Kurt pays the bills. Kurt makes it possible so I can get up and go, okay, well, what crazy weird thing am I going to do in the studio today? Or maybe I'll paint the furniture or whatever, you know what I mean? I get to do that because of that sort of alchemy of our relationship, because it is about both of us. It's not just Kurt. It's not Kurt giving me a gift. It's us creating something together. Very much so.
And we have the alchemy of inviting Jess into our home to help you make the work, because I can support the work, but I go out in the big wide world. Mm-hmm. And so your relationship with Jess allowed you to really realize all of this.
Yeah.
And I just thought how I grew up on a cattle and log farm, where I grew up cutting down, falling timber and cutting down trees. That intention wasn't that, but that aspect for me helped solidify a sense of familialness.
Yeah.
And just as like an adoptee outside woods, star gazing weirdo, it felt very, I was like, oh sure, this feels natural. I think that's why it worked.
It has been very natural. It's been
really, yeah, nice. Unusually natural.
So maybe we'll end our conversation with the words unusually natural. All right.
Yes.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you,
Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you. Thank you, Ryan.
Let's have drinks.
Yeah.
Do both things.